The following podcast contains mature language and discussions that are not suitable for younger audiences. The opinions voiced in this podcast are our own. We are not experts on the topic we present, but have conducted our own research. Listener discretion is advised. This will be a particularly gruesome episode with depictions of violence, death, and descriptions of crime scenes. If you are uncomfortable with these things, then this episode might not be for you. Otherwise, keep listening. Welcome back to the Strange and Undecided podcast. I'm your host, Jarrett, joined by my co-host,
Patrick.
Welcome back, everyone.
Hi, everyone. Now into the dark episode we've got today.
Yes. Episode 10.
The big 1-0.
Yes. So as far as I'm concerned, for the most part, serial killers really aren't covered in Canadian media compared to the way they are in the States. So not a lot of people have heard of these cases. And if you are, it's mostly localized per province from what I have seen.
We do not sensationalize our mass killings as they do in other countries to the south of us.
So are you ready for this?
I don't know. The way you're looking at me, I'm not so sure.
It's quite a gruesome episode.
Well then, let's do it.
In Vancouver, British Columbia, 65 women went missing from Vancouver's downtown east side between the years 1978 and 2001. Probably more that weren't ever reported. Of that 65, 26 were found to have been murdered. These murders led to Canada's largest investigation of serial killer Robert Picton. Robert Picton was a pig farmer living in a small town in Vancouver. Somehow, he was able to get away with murdering these women without neighbors or authorities realizing. Or did they?
Oh, a twist right off the bat?
I'm going to provide a background of Robert Picton here for the sole purpose of context. There are events that happened in his early life that may explain why he committed his horrifically heinous acts later in life. But I will stress this. Explain doesn't mean excuse. We are not trying to sensationalize this depraved individual. We are simply here to inform and educate people listening. Robert William Picton was born to Leonard Francis Picton and Louise Helene Arnall. They were a family of pig farmers who lived in a little town in British Columbia called Port Coquitlam, which is approximately 27 kilometers or 17 miles east of Vancouver. Robert had an older sister, Linda Louise Wright, who ended up being sent to live with relatives in Vancouver, as the pig farming lifestyle was believed to be a poor environment to raise a girl. Robert also had a younger brother named David Francis Picton. Both of the boys worked on the farm, starting at an early age. Their mother, Louise, was an interesting character, to say the least. She was incredibly demanding of the boys, forcing them to work very long hours, and would be more concerned about the pigs rather than the well-being of her sons. Louise would send the boys to school in a disgusting state, where both boys would typically be unwashed, be wearing dirty clothes, and smell like what you think a pig farm would smell like. This earned the Picton boys the nickname of Stinky Piggy from kids at their school.
Poopy Pictons.
Nevertheless, Robert had a strong attachment to his mother, most likely because he had very little interaction with his abusive father. When Robert was 12, he had saved up enough money to buy a calf from a livestock auction. He raised the calf on the farm and took care of it. He cared very deeply for this calf.
You saved up all your money for a calf? Wow.
I guess that's just the farming lifestyle. Like, that's what they did. Like, in certain towns close to us, they have livestock auctions all the time, and that's just kind of the way people live. This calf was just like a pet to him. One day when he came home from school looking for the calf, he couldn't find it, so his father told him to check the barn. He found that the calf had been slaughtered by his father. The next event in Robert's life is quite unexpected. On October 16th, 1967, Robert's brother David was driving down a road in their father's truck after just getting his license. 14-year-old Tim Barrett was walking down the same road, and the details of what happened next are blurry, but David hit Tim Barrett with his truck from behind. Not knowing what to do and panicking, David went back home and told his mother about hitting the boy. Both Louise and David returned to the spot where Tim had been hit and found him lying there on the side of the road, alive and breathing. Louise bent down to inspect the boy, and instead of helping him, she pushed him down into the ditch on the side of the road. It was a drainage ditch, or storm ditch of sorts, that was filled with water. Tim Barrett was found dead the next day, and the autopsy revealed that the cause of death was drowning. Despite being hit by the truck and having severe injuries, they were not the reason he died. It seems like killing people would run in the Picton family.
Lack of morals in this Picton household.
Oh, for sure. Some of the articles that I read and opinions in those articles thought that the mom basically just treated him as if he was an animal on their own farm, that he wasn't actually a human being. It was just something that could be disposed of.
Mm.
So pretty awful.
Pretty dark. Did the mom go to jail or anything? Or?
Nope. She was never charged with anything, but David was sent to juvenile prison for hitting him, but it was ruled an accidental death. It didn't come to light until later when Robert told a close friend that his mother had actually killed him.
So they just found this boy drowning in a ditch. Did they see any blunt force trauma to his body when he got hit by the truck? Or did they not know that at that point?
Yeah, when they performed the autopsy, they could see that he was hit by a car, but the actual reason that he died wasn't from the car accident. It was from drowning in the ditch because she pushed him into the ditch. Robert's father died in 1977, and his mother died in 1979. Robert, David, and their sister Linda inherited the farm and ended up selling parts of the property for urban development, earning a total of $5.16 million Canadian. The property was reduced to 6.5 hectares, and with all the money Robert and David had, very little work was done to improve the property. A worker named Bill Hiscox stated that the farm was a, quote, creepy-looking place, end quote.
I mean, if you're poorly educated and whatever, you just inherit a bunch of money, you don't think to invest it, make your farm better, just spend it, have fun, and forget all your worries.
Pretty much. And they weren't really good in school. Like, Robert was in the special ed class because he just could not perform on an academic level. Oddly enough, instead of a guard dog, a 600-pound pig allegedly patrolled the property.
Yo, pigs are scary. My grandparents' farm had one.
Oh, really?
It was, yeah.
600 pounds is insane.
Huge.
The brothers ended up throwing parties, and it got to the point where they were sued for neglecting agriculture and violating their zoning conditions. Instead of the farm being used for farming and pigs, the brothers, quote, altered a large farm building on the land for the purpose of holding dances, concerts, and other recreations. In 1996, the farm operations had been neglected so much that the Picton brothers started the Piggies Palace Good Times Society. It was registered federally as a charity that was supposed to raise funds for services, organizations, by hosting events such as dances and shows. Ultimately, neighbors complained about the noise, the drug use, and the drunkenness of people attending these events. The parties were attended by as many as 2,000 people, including Hell's Angels bikers and various sex workers from Vancouver's downtown east side. Vancouver's downtown east side is known as the Skid Row of Canada for its high levels of poverty, substance abuse, and sex workers. Robert knew the place well, as he would take unwanted animal parts to a rendering plant in the downtown east side. Robert would then drive around a 10-block strip called the Low Track. He was known to offer the sex workers in that area money and drugs, and would even take some of these women back to his farm. As the years passed, the rates of women disappearing increased, and talk of a serial killer hunting women in downtown east side spread like wildfire. The presence of a serial killer was so heavily believed that the sex workers working Low Track started working in groups. They even went so far as to write down license plates of cars that picked women up. Despite this effort, women continued to disappear. By 1991, families of the missing women demanded that police take these cases more seriously. However, the police response was slow at best.
With the stigma around the sex workers, I imagine at that time the priority wasn't that high.
You're right about that.
The suggestion that a serial killer was at play here was denied by Vancouver police, and they didn't believe that the missing women were dead at all. Their reasoning included that there were no bodies or evidence of any kind, and it would be a major stress on their resources to investigate all of the disappearances to the level that was requested. According to police, the most likely explanation was that these missing women had simply moved away or died of a drug overdose. which I find interesting because they didn't think they were dead, but then provided an explanation of, oh, they might have died of an overdose. Police were criticized for having such a flippant attitude towards these people and were accused of giving these women low priority, not due to resources, but because they were sex workers, with a number of missing women being indigenous as well. Sometimes vulnerable populations are targeted by serial killers because they know police didn't care as much. The police department's denial of a serial killer was a result of being stuck in their ways and not exploring new investigative methods such as psychological criminal profiling. Years passed with no answers for the families of the missing women. Moving back to Piggy's Palace, the fun had taken a violent turn. On March 22, 1997, Robert was charged for the attempted murder of a woman named Wendy Lynn Eistetter. She was a sex worker who he had brought back to the farm one night. For some reason, he ended up handcuffing her and stabbed her several times with a knife. Somehow, she managed to get the knife away from Robert, stab him back, and escape. She ran off the farm and out onto the road, desperately trying to flag down a car. Someone stopped for her and called an ambulance. While Wendy was in the hospital receiving emergency surgery, Robert made his way to the same hospital and received treatment for his injuries.
Could you imagine? I wonder if she knew that he was in the same building.
I don't think she did. That's the crazy part.
Better that way.
Yeah, probably. One of the people treating Robert found a key in his pocket that went to the handcuffs that were on Wendy's wrist. Robert was arrested and charged with attempted murder, assault with a weapon, and forcible confinement. Shockingly enough, the case was stayed and eventually dropped, and Robert was released on a $2,000 bond as the prosecution felt that Wendy was not a competent witness who would be able to give accurate testimony because she was a drug addict. Robert claimed that she was hitchhiking and that she attacked him. Violence seemed to be a natural part of the Picton family. David Picton was convicted of sexual assault back in 1992. He was merely handed a fine of $1,000 and given 30 days probation, practically a slap on the wrist. David had allegedly attacked a woman in his trailer on the farm. However, she said that she had escaped. Piggy's Palace ended up being shut down in 2000 due to legal pressure. The police were, quote, authorized to arrest and remove any person attending future events at the farm. At this point in time, suspicion began to arise about the activities going on at the Picton farm. During the spring of 1999, an informant gave information to the Vancouver police about a woman's body seen hanging in the Picton slaughterhouse.
Jesus, that escalated quickly.
Yep, it really does. Police wanted to question the people who saw this. When police made contact with Lynn Ellingson, she denied the story. However, at a much later date, she admitted that on March 20th, 1999, she did indeed see a body hanging in the slaughterhouse.
Who was Lynn in relation to Picton's?
She was somebody who would buy drugs from Robert.
So she got nervous with the police pressure and retracted her statements.
Basically, when asked why she didn't report what she saw and lied before, she responded by saying she was scared of Robert and she needed him for drugs and money. Happening close to the same time in early 1999, a man who worked on the Picton farm named Bill Hiscox, as I mentioned before, began to notice that there were women who visited the farm and were later listed missing in the local news.
I don't know how this story ends, but to me it resembles the story of Ed Gein down in the States, which is what they based the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies off of.
Oh yeah, I can see that. I guess with the slaughterhouse, yeah.
Yeah, people hanging and yeah, eerie stuff. Let's continue.
This information given by Bill was reported to the RCMP. However, they seemed to give no notice to his concerns. RCMP stands for Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Bill contacted the police a second time after talking to a woman named Lisa Yelds, who was a close friend of Robert's. She told Bill that she had seen women's clothes, purses, and IDs at his farm. Bill believed these to belong to the missing women. Police attempted questioning Lisa, but she was uncooperative. The police explanation as to why nothing was done was because they could not obtain a search warrant from hearsay evidence. That's verbal information given from someone who is not a direct witness. They needed the people who had actually seen criminal activity to make a report. Finally, in 2001, the RCMP and Vancouver Police Department formed a joint task force to look into the disappearances of missing women from downtown Eastside called Project Evenhanded. A former employee of the Picton farm was a man named Scott Chubb. He had reported to the RCMP that he had witnessed illegal guns in the Picton's trailer home. Since he had viewed it directly and made a report, a search warrant could be obtained, and on February 5th, a raid of the pig farm was conducted. Robert and his brother David were both charged with storing a firearm that did not conform to regulations, possession of firearms without a license, and possession of a loaded restricted firearm without a license. Both Robert and David were released, but Robert was kept under a watchful eye by law enforcement.
It's about time.
About time. Police had to obtain a second search warrant, which was granted based on what they had recovered on the property as part of the missing women investigation. During this time, Robert was not permitted to enter the property until police were finished conducting a thorough investigation. The police ended up finding items connecting missing women to the property. Some of the evidence they discovered were handcuffs, women's clothing, women's shoes, various pieces of jewelry, and an asthma inhaler prescribed to a woman named Serena Abbotsway. She was one of the missing women. A DNA test of a blood sample found in the Picton trailer on the property was confirmed to belong to a woman named Mona Wilson, also listed as missing.
This guy really did not believe that he was going to get caught. Either that, or he's really dumb. It sounds like he's just having these pieces of evidence laying around willy-nilly.
On February 22nd, Robert was arrested again, and this time charged with two counts of first-degree murder for the deaths of Serena Abbotsway and Mona Wilson. The list did not end here. It just kept growing. April 2nd, Robert was charged with three more counts of first-degree murder for the murders of Jacqueline McDonald, Diane Rock, and Heather Bottomley. On April 9th, a sixth charge was made for the murder of Andrea Jonesbury, and was followed later by a seventh charge for Brenda Wolfe. The investigation kept turning up more missing women. On September 20th, four more charges were made for the murders of Georgina Pappin, Patricia Johnson, Helen Hallmark, and Jennifer Firminger. October 3rd, four more charges were made for the murders of Heather Chinnock, Tanya Hollick, Sherry Irving, and Inga Hall. Almost 3 years later, on May 26, 2005, 12 more charges were made for the murders of Kara Ellis, Andrea Borhaven, Deborah Lynn Jones, Marnie Frey, Tiffany Drew, Carrie Koski, Sarah DeVries, Cynthia Felix, Angela Jardine, Wendy Crawford, Diana Melnick, and one Jane Doe.
That's a heck of a list.
This brings the total numbers of murdered women found at the farm to 27.
Was this all discovered through the police investigative actions, or was it, did he admit to any of these?
He completely didn't admit to anything. This was all just what the police uncovered. As we'll see later before the trial, he said that he was innocent.
So he just had mountains of evidence laying around.
Yeah, exactly.
Do we know where he put the bodies?
We'll get to that in a bit. Excavations of the farm continued, and the total cost of the investigation was estimated to be around $70 million by the end of 2003.
Wow.
The Picton Pig Farm was now the largest crime scene in Canadian history. 200,000 DNA samples were taken from the site, along with 600,000 exhibits. All of the buildings on the property have been demolished, apart from one small barn, and the entire property was fenced off. The forensic investigation and analysis was extremely difficult, as the environment the bodies were left in caused them to decompose, be eaten by insects, as well as the pigs from the farm. To conduct an efficient and effective investigation, the forensic team brought in heavy equipment, and this was in the form of two 15-meter or 50-foot flat conveyor belts, and they used soil sifters to try and find evidence of human remains in the 383,000 cubic yards of soil.
That's hard to picture, but it's a lot.
It is a lot. What comes next is horrifying, to say the least. On March 10th, 2004, the government found information that led them to believe that Robert may have minced up human flesh and mixed it with pork and sold it to the public.
Oh, God.
British Columbia's health authority issued a safety warning following the release of this information. However, it was determined that this was never distributed on a commercial scale, only to Robert's friends and people who visited the farm.
Only to his loved ones. Gee, thanks, Robert.
According to interviews with Robert, he had fed parts of the bodies to his pigs on the farm. He also brought other parts of bodies to the rendering plant on downtown Eastside that had been mixed with pig parts.
That's disgusting.
Robert had a preliminary hearing to determine if there was enough evidence for a proper trial. This lasted from January to July of 2003. One of the victims, the Jane Doe, was removed from the charges due to a lack of evidence. Due to the sheer number of charges, as well as the intricate legalities,
Justice James Williams decided to split the charges into a group of 6
and then another group of the remaining 20. According to the justice, it would be hard on the jury to try Robert on 26 charges and would lead to an increased chance of a mistrial. Instead, they tried him on the first 6 charges, which did not start until January 22, 2007. These 6 charges were chosen specifically as they had evidence that set them apart from the others. When Robert was in jail before the trial, an undercover police officer pretending to be Robert's cellmate listened to Robert boast about the murders. He claimed to have killed 49 women and was upset about not being able to make it to an even 50. The confession was videotaped, and I will include it here for those who want to listen. Keep in mind, this is kind of a poorly recorded audio file.
So if you find it hard to hear, the videos online have subtitles so you can follow along better if you so choose to. So just to summarize what he said in that audio clip, he said that he took bodies to the rendering plant, and that was the one I referred to earlier, that's downtown Eastside. And he also claimed to have killed 49 women. He was upset about not being able to get to an even 50, or as the officer referred to it as, half a hundred.
Yeah, so this piece of shit, just boasting about it. So he admitted to 49 there, and how many did he get charged for?
26. But technically, it was only 6 as of the time of the trial because they were just going on the 6 charges, not all 26.
So there's a heck of a lot more bodies out there that we don't know of.
Absolutely. Still a lot of missing women. As stated earlier, only 26 charges were made, and that was only for those who could be identified with supporting evidence found on Robert's property. At the time, there was a media ban, but it was later lifted, and the details of the investigation and what was found was released. Here is some of the evidence. 80 unidentified DNA profiles, roughly half male and half female, were detected on the property. In Robert's trailer, the following was found: a loaded .22 revolver with a dildo over the barrel and 1 round fired.
What the fuck?
Boxes of .357 Magnum handgun ammunition, night vision goggles, 2 pairs of faux fur-lined handcuffs, a syringe with 3 milliliters of blue liquid inside, and Spanish fly aphrodisiac. In a videotaped recording played for the jury, Picton claimed to have attached the dildo to his weapon as a makeshift silencer. This explanation was impractical at best, as revolvers are near impossible to silence in this manner. Scott Chubb's videotaped testimony saying Robert had told him a good way to kill a female heroin addict was to inject her with windshield washer fluid. A second videotaped testimony showed an associate of Robert's, Andrew Bellwood, saying Robert said he killed sex workers by handcuffing and then strangling them. He would then bleed and gut them before feeding them to pigs. Photos were taken of the contents of a garbage can found in Robert's slaughterhouse, which held some remains of victim Mona Wilson. There were also jaw bones and teeth found lying around the slaughterhouse, as well as skulls cut in half with hands and feet stuffed inside and heads stuffed in the freezer. On December 9th, 2007, Robert was found guilty for 6 counts of murder in the second degree and was sentenced to life imprisonment in a federal penitentiary without the possibility of parole for 25 years. The reason he was convicted in the second degree was because people were not fully convinced that he acted alone. So during the trial, what I found in my research was that some people admitted that they knew what was going on the property. And because of that, the defense used that to basically say that it was impossible or not practical that Robert did this all by himself. So the only way the jury...
Where was the brother during this time?
I have no idea. No, he was living somewhere else, or he was on the farm. They had their own trailers and stuff, but I'm not exactly sure specifically where he lived. But there has been speculation that he was also involved.
Sounds like they were pretty close in running this little business that they had. I feel like it'd be hard to miss 50 people going missing on your family's farm.
Yeah, you've got a good point. And based on his history as well, it's not far-fetched to think that he could have been involved in some manner.
After Robert's conviction from the trial, British Columbia Crown prosecutors pushed to have another trial to convict on the other 20 charges. However, on August 4th, 2010, the Crown said they would no longer be pursuing the other 20 charges, as further add-on convictions would not add anything to Robert's sentence. His sentence was already the maximum possible one under Canadian law. Mixed emotions arose from this, where some of the families of the 20 victims were enraged with this decision, while others were relieved that they would not have to endure another trial. Because of the severity of the crimes committed, as well as no reasoning as to why the police didn't act sooner, an inquiry was made in 2010. In December 2012, the Missing Women Commission of Inquiry issued a report which was aptly titled Forsaken. The inquiry highlighted, quote, blatant failures by the police. This included poor criminal investigative work, which was a direct result of police prejudice against sex workers and Indigenous women. This blatant disregard of these women has led to, quote, a tragedy of epic proportions. The inquiry had 63 recommendations issued in total. This included the formation of the Greater Vancouver Regional Police Force, which would allow for more effective and less fragmented police cooperation. The inquiry also called for more funding to be allocated to women's emergency shelters and compensation for the children of the missing and murdered women. These children received $50,000 in compensation. The Vancouver Police Department ended up implementing several policy and procedural changes to its missing persons investigations as a result of the inquiry report. A missing persons unit was made to be a standard part of the police department. Investigations into missing persons were to begin immediately without hesitation. Family members would be advised and informed before the release of sensitive information, and case files are kept open until the missing person is located. A press conference was held at a later date where Deputy Chief Constable Doug Lepard of the Vancouver Police Department apologized to the victim's family, saying, quote, I wish from the bottom of my heart that we would have caught him sooner. I wish that the several agencies involved that we could have done better in so many ways. I wish that all the mistakes that were made we could undo. And I wish that more lives would have been saved. So on my behalf, and behalf of the Vancouver Police Department and all the men and women that worked on this investigation, I would say to the families how sorry we all are for your losses and because we did not catch this monster sooner.
It's also pertinent to mention here that in an article that was published in 2023 in December, the RCMP was looking to dispose of evidence from the Robert Picton case and currently is being furiously objected by the families of the victims. The case is still open, and there are still many answers left unsolved and victims yet to be found. So the reason that I chose this case was because if you notice earlier, when Robert received his maximum sentence,
he would be eligible for parole after 25 years. About 2 weeks ago from the time of recording this episode, Robert Picton became eligible to apply for day parole. However, as of February 22, 2024, no hearing has been scheduled according to the Parole Board of Canada.
That's a scary thought.
The fact that this guy can just walk free after committing the amount of atrocities that he did? Yeah, that's ridiculous.
Well, I hope this parole gets denied.
I hope so too.
So there's a lot to process in this episode, so I'm just going to leave you with this. Was justice really served here? I'll let you decide. All right, so that's the end of the Robert Picton case.
That was heavy.
Very heavy. Not a happy topic in the slightest.
No.
Initially, when I was choosing a topic for this week, I came across this one and I had no clue about what happened. And this is all fresh and very new to me.
No, I never heard about it either. But I guess it's kind of a good thing that we're not glorifying this monster.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that. And in no way do I sensationalize anything. This is more for, like I said before, more educational purposes. And it's something that's still affecting people. So I feel like it's important to talk about.
If anything positive came out of this case, it's the fact that the police are taking these cases more seriously now.
At least we hope so. But yeah,
and absolutely. It always takes a tragedy to reform something that should have happened a long time ago.
Yeah, you never hope it gets to that point, but unfortunately, that's the way things are. I'll ask you this. Do you think the events of his early life led him to be the monster that he is, or was he already predetermined to be that way?
Personally, I don't think anybody is born a monster. I definitely think it's a learned behavior. So like we mentioned with the mother, clearly he's seen violence and that blatant murder of the boy getting hit by the car and his mother pushing him into the ditch.
Also something that I researched as well and I saw that was really sad. But I guess, again, this is all speculation. I guess when he was younger, he didn't like taking showers. He was scared to take showers because he was never bathed on a regular basis. Hence their bullying in school. But apparently he would hide in the pig carcasses when he didn't want to go for a shower and like hide from his parents. Like that was just normal for him, which I think is just disgusting in every single sense of the word. But just the kind of environment that he was in definitely did not help his case in any way.
Well, it's very sad too when you think of the way that he grew up. If the circumstances were different, if he was born to a better off family, this might not have happened, right? It's just the way that he was treated and what he was taught was right and wrong were clearly absurd.
Yeah, and it's no excuse regardless for his actions. But yeah, definitely from what we at least know about serial killers, it's never just one single factor by any means. But yeah, definitely his family life and his upbringing, I would say personally definitely contributed to kind of how he turned out for the most part.
Yeah, also I think one common thing with serial killers and their upbringing is a history of maybe head trauma. Anything of that nature that you've uncovered?
I didn't see anything in regards to that, but he did have an abusive father. I don't know how he was abused. I'm assuming it was physically. Some of the stuff I read said he was physically abusive. So I don't know if he hit his head as a kid or I didn't see anything like that. If anybody does know, please email us at strangeanduncided@gmail.com and correct us or leave a comment. It would be greatly appreciated. But from my research that I conducted, I didn't see anything in terms of him having brain damage.
How about isolation? Was he isolated from his family?
He was with them on a regular basis, but he was forced to work all the time. So he didn't really have that motherly affection.
Yeah, one other common theme we see with serial killers is a lack of affection, usually from the mother's side. Do we know of any of that?
Yeah, she was just a hard ass for the most part, and she didn't give them any kind of affection or attention, but he still was close with her, which was interesting.
It's like he wanted the affection like any child does with his mother.
Yep.
And you don't know better when you're a kid. You think the affection your mom is giving you is appropriate. You don't have any context besides what you know.
Going back to the isolation topic, when I mentioned earlier that his father had slaughtered the calf, he said in an interview that he didn't talk to his family for like a week afterwards. So during those X number of days, 7 days, however long it was, he was very isolated. And I feel like that was also
a crucial point for him because he actually cared about something.
Yeah, so that was a seed of resentment just growing all those years.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder what the life of the sister ended up being like because she moved away because working on a pig farm wasn't meant for girls at that time.
Yeah, as far as I know, nothing. She wasn't a criminal. I'm not 100% sure though, so don't quote me on that. But I didn't come across anything involving her and criminal activity in my research.
Looks like that was the biggest blessing of her life.
For sure. All right, and that's going to end our episode for tonight. If you have any ideas for the show or want your story featured, email us at strangeandundecided@gmail.com. New episodes will be posted every Sunday, and don't forget to follow us to stay updated. All right, we'd like to thank you for listening.
And good night.